Howdy, it's the 6th of May, 2025. This is the Arizona Daily Star, brought to you through Sun Sounds of Arizona and read by David Grant. And taking up most of the front page is Some Communities Bank on Trump's Push for Coal. And this is from Susan Montoya Bryan of the Associated Press, Joseph City. Brantley Baird never misses a chance to talk history, from how his great-grandmother helped settle the town of Snowflake long before Arizona was granted statehood, to tales of riding to school bareback and tethering his horse outside the one-room schoolhouse. His family worked the land, raised livestock, watched the railroads come and go, and cattle empires rise and fall. Then came the coal-fired power plants built throughout northern Arizona and northwestern New Mexico to power progress to distant western cities. The plants would play their own role in the history of the region and could wind up at the center of its uncertain future. The Cholla Power Plant stands just down the road from where Baird, 88, has been building a museum to showcase covered wagons, weathered farm implements, and other remnants of frontier days. For years, the power plant powered the local economy, providing jobs and tax revenues for the unincorporated community of Joseph City, its schools and neighboring towns, but now the vapors from its stacks have dissipated. These days, change is in the air. Cholla is the latest in a long line of U.S. coal-fired plants to retire, shutting down in March. Arizona Public Service said it had become too costly to operate due to strict environmental regulations. The mandates were aimed at reining in coal-burning utilities, long viewed by scientists as major contributors to warming the planet. Last month, however, President Donald Trump reversed the course, signing new executive orders aimed at restoring beautiful clean coal to the forefront of U.S. energy supplies. He urged his administration to find ways to reopen Cholla and delay the planned retirements of others. As part of his push towards energy independence, Trump has pledged to tap domestic sources, coal included, to fuel a new wave of domestic manufacturing and technology, namely innovations in artificial intelligence. In the West, where the vision of far-off politicians sometimes crashes against reality, Baird and many of his neighbors were encouraged that Trump put Cholla in the spotlight, but there is some skepticism about what the utilities will do with the plants. As many jobs as it gives people, as much help just to our school district right here that we could get out of there, we are hoping that it will come back too, said Baird, who used to work at the Cholla plant and has served on the Joseph City School Board. Yet, he and others wonder if it's too late for coal. Coal-burning plants retiring. Just weeks before Trump announced his plan, the U.S. Energy Information Administration projected a 65% increase of retirement of coal-fired generation in 2025 compared with last year. The largest plant on that list is an 1,800-megawatt Intermountain Power Project in Utah. It's being replaced by a plant capable of burning natural gas and hydrogen. Utilities already looking to increase capacity aren't sure Trump's orders will lead them back to coal. I think it's safe to say those plants are scheduled or slated to retire are probably going to move in that direction for a couple of reasons, said Todd Schnittler, CEO of the Electric Power Supply Association, which represents power plant owners, one of which is very difficult to plan multi-million or billion-dollar investments for environmental retrofits and other things on an executive order versus a legislative approach. Last month, Republicans in the Arizona legislature sent a letter to U.S. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum warning that the economic fallout from the 2019 closure of Navajo Generating Station is still reverberating. The stacks were demolished and the mine that supplied the plant closed. At the San Juan Generating Station in northwestern New Mexico, operations ended in 2022. Stuck in the middle are Joseph City and other communities where life revolves around a power plant. Residents hope Trump can help keep them in the energy race for another generation. From Joseph City to Springerville, they've been preparing to absorb major hits to the job market, tax rolls, and school enrollment. Options are slim in Apache and Navajo counties, two of Arizona's poorest. Utility executives told Arizona regulators recently that reopening Cholla would be costly for customers and that they plan to push ahead with renewable energy. The plant's infrastructure would be preserved as a possible site for future nuclear or gas-fired power generation, and the Springerville generating station could be repurposed once the last units are retired in 2032. The utility that runs the coal-fired Coronado generating station just 30 miles away in St. John's also has plans to convert to natural gas. Wind resistance. In Springerville, the idea of spoiling the surrounding grasslands and ancient volcano fields with 112 wind turbines with blades standing taller than Seattle's Space Needle provokes outrage. Banners and posters objecting to the proposal are plastered around town. "They all know that this won't work and that we can't rely on wind and solar," said Doug Henderson, a Springerville plant retiree who now sits on the town council. He says the coal-fired generation can accommodate swings in demands regardless of whether there's sunshine or wind. Springerville Mayor Shelley Reedhead and others are fighting to keep the wind farm from happening, saying repurposing the Springerville coal plant would mean more jobs and preserve the surrounding landscape. "We also survive on tourism, and people don't want to come here and look at that," Reedhead said of the turbines. The Western Drug and General Store is adorned with a tiny American flags tacked outside. A sign advertises canning supplies, but locals joke that you can get anything there, from slippers to rifles. Andrea Hobson works at the register and knows everyone by name. She moved to Springerville about 20 years ago from California and says it's hard to imagine a community without the power plant. "It would be a ghost town, it really would, and that's the heart of this town, filling the economic void." Springerville's leadership have lost sleep trying to figure out what industries might fill the void. At stake are about 350 jobs, dozens of contract employees, and the businesses that they support, from the general store to the new frozen yogurt shop to the hospital and local churches. Some workers drive an hour to the Springerville plant every day, meaning other communities will also lose out, said Randall Penrod, a former crew manager at the plant. With retirement looming, the plant has trimmed its workforces. Henderson, the Springerville town council member, fears it could take years to permit a new plant. Reedhead is more hopeful after attending meetings with members of Arizona's congressional delegation and utility executives. She thinks that the Trump administration can reduce the red tape and get new plants up and running. The development of artificial intelligence and its thirst for power gives the mission a sense of urgency. "I think our politicians at the state level have realized, with AI's need for power, that if we don't get on board and get on board soon, we're going to be left behind," she said. Some energy analysts say that Trump's support of coal is mostly symbolic, since utilities hold the key. Others say diversifying energy sources is a must, as the U.S. sees increases in power demands predicted for the first time in decades. AI might be artificial, but the electricity it needs is very real. And in some regions, coal still keeps the lights on when other sources may blink, said Scott Siegel, a partner with the Washington, D.C.-based firm Bracewell LLP. He said that power markets don't care about politics, just reliability, affordability, and sustainability. Just outside Joseph City, crews are building what will be one of the largest solar and battery storage projects in Arizona. The solar panels will be installed on leased private land, including Baird's sprawling ranch. While not a fan of all the dust being kicked up, Baird knows that the advent of solar is just another of many changes he's seen in his lifetime. He has no idea what the next 100 years might look like. Hell, who knows? You know, when it comes right down to it, we'll just have to wait and see. Associated Press writer Mark Levy in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, contributed to this report. Administration says it will pay immigrants to leave voluntarily. Rebecca Santana of Associated Press. Washington, pushing forward with its mass deportation agenda, President Donald Trump's administration said Monday it will pay $1,000 to immigrants who are in the United States illegally and return to their home country voluntarily. The Department of Homeland Security said in a news release it will also pay for travel assistance, and that people who use an app called CBP Home to tell the government that they plan to return home will be deprioritized for detention and removal by immigrant enforcement. If you are here illegally, self-deportation is the best, safest, and most cost-effective way to leave the United States to avoid arrest, said Secretary Kristi Noem. The department claimed it had already paid for a plane ticket for one migrant to return to Honduras from Chicago, and said more tickets were booked for this week and next. Trump made an immigration enforcement and mass deportation of immigrants to the United States illegally a centerpiece of his campaign, and he's following through. During the first months of his administration, it's a costly, resource-intensive endeavor. While the Republican administration asked Congress for massive increases in resources for the Immigration Customs Enforcement Department responsible for removing people from the country, it also pushed people to self-deport. It coupled this self-deportation push with television ads threatening action against people in the U.S. illegally and social media images showing immigration enforcement arrests and migrants being sent to a prison in El Salvador. The Trump administration often portrayed self-deportation as a way for migrants to preserve their ability to return to the United States one day. But Aaron Reichlin-Melnick, a senior fellow at the American Immigration Council, which advocates for immigrants, says there's a lot for migrants to be cautious about in the latest offer from Homeland Security. He said it's often worse for people to leave the country and not fight their case in immigration court, especially if they're already in removal proceedings. He said if migrants are in removal proceedings and don't show up in court, they can automatically get a deportation order, and leaving the country usually counts as abandoning many applications for relief, including asylum applications. Homeland Security didn't indicate it coordinated with a migrant immigration court, so there are no repercussions for people in immigration court if they leave, he said. People's immigration status is not as simple as this makes it out to be, said Reichlin-Melnick. He questioned where Homeland Security could get the money and the authorization to make the payments. He suggested that they are necessary because the administration can't arrest and remove as many people as it promised, so it has to encourage people to do it on their own. They're not getting their numbers, he said. As part of its self-deportation effort, the Trump administration transformed an app that was used by the Biden administration to allow almost 1 million plus migrants to schedule appointments to enter the country in a tool to help migrants return home. Under the Biden administration, it was called CBP-1. Now it's dubbed CBP Home. Homeland Security claimed thousands of migrants use the app to self-deport. But Mark Krikorian, who heads the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates for less immigration, says he doesn't see the offer of paying people to go home as an admission that something in the Trump administration's immigration enforcement agenda isn't working. Considering the millions of people who are in the country illegally, he said, it's impossible to deport all of them. So the administration has to combine its enforcement efforts with encouraging people to go home voluntarily. Krikorian says he supports the idea of paying migrants to leave, though he questioned how it would work in reality. How do you make sure that they've actually gone home? Do you make them sign an agreement where they agree not to challenge their removal if they were to come back? He questioned. The execution matters, but the concept is sound. Other countries have tried various iterations of paying migrants to return home. There's a reason it's attractive to governments wanting to encourage migrants to go. It costs less to buy someone a plane ticket and some incentive money than it does to pay to find them, detain them if necessary, and wait for the courts to rule on their case, then send them home. A 2011 2011 study by the Migration Policy Institute and the European University Institute found that there were some 128 programs, often referred as pay-to-go programs, around the world. But the study found, with a few exceptions, such as one program to return people in the 1990s from Germany to Bosnia, these voluntary return programs generally failed at encouraging large numbers of people to go home. It's not clear whether these programs resulted in migrants who took the payments are actually staying in their home countries and not trying to emigrate again. Landslide University of Arizona faculty vote urges Trump fight. This is from Prerana Sanapavanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. University of Arizona faculty voted in a landslide to urge UA President Suresh Garamella to defend the university's bedrock principles from ideological and governmental attacks on universities and higher education, quote unquote. Out of a total 977 votes cast by faculty members on the referendum, 926 votes, or 91%, were in favor of approving it. The U of A Faculty Senate does not need to vote because the direct faculty referendum speaks for itself, said U of A chair of the faculty, Lila Hudson, while announcing the results at a Monday meeting, almost a week after faculty senate leaders sent the referendum to all U of A faculty members for a vote. The votes were recorded anonymously in an online voting system from Tuesday through Friday last week. U of A spokesperson Mitch Zack shared a statement Monday on behalf of the U of A saying, we value engagement with the University of Arizona faculty, staff, students, and community members as we chart a path forward. U of A leaders are directly engaged with our federal congressional delegation, state legislators, and agency officials. And we have been actively collaborating with the Association of American Universities, the Association of Public and Land-Grant Universities, and our peer institutes. We will continue to focus on student success, research excellence, and meaningful engagement with our state. The referendum urged Garamella and the Arizona Board of Regents, which oversees the state's three public universities, to legally contest and refuse compliance with unlawful demands by the federal administration, as it said, threaten academic freedom, university governance, and the constitutional rights and safety of students, faculty, and staff. Sign the American Association of Colleges and University call for constructive engagement, a statement signed by 612 university presidents across the U.S. as a united front against the Trump administration's executive order on higher education and universities. Participate in the establishment of a mutual academic defense compact among public land-grant universities. None of Arizona's public university presidents, Garamella, Arizona State University President Michael Crow, and Northern Arizona University President Jose Luis Cruz Rivera have signed the AAC and U statement. Zack has not responded to questions about whether Garamella intends to sign the AAC and U statement. However, incoming U of A Provost Patricia Prelock, the current interim president of the University of Vermont, has signed it. I all share a foreshadowing of hope that Prelock's signing of the statement is a very good sign, Hudson said on Monday's faculty senate meeting. I am optimistic that she will work with us on a new set of agreements and principles for faculty governance and shared governance. The referendum was sent to the U of A faculty by Hudson, Secretary of the Faculty Katie Zeiders, and Faculty Senate Chair Mona Heimel. Hudson said that the faculty senate leaders were motivated by internal pressure as many of their colleagues reached out to them from different disciplines, ranks, and statuses across the current political climate on the university campuses. That came after more than 60 regents and distinguished professors at the U of A wrote Garamella asking him to fight what they called unlawful conditions being placed on federal funding and other federal actions. Garamella in a letter back to those top professors, emphasize the importance of federal and state funding. We also have a responsibility to comply with the laws and guidelines that apply to our public universities, he wrote. Garamella's statement then about funding was similar to Zach's on Monday. U of A's commitment includes promoting an environment where all the members of our community find belonging and purpose. With the more than $470 million in federal research grants, $380 million in state funding, and over $70 million in federal Pell grants supporting 22% of our student body, we are committed to sustaining the work and well-being of our students, faculty, and staff while preserving the long-term stability of the university, Zach said. After the referendum was sent, Gary Rhodes, a U of A professor of higher education, sent an email to the U of A administrators, including Garamella and Prelock, urging them to constructively engage with the Faculty Senate and the state and federal governments on the referendum's recommendations. Rhodes advised against self-destructive detachment from them and complicity with state federal government threats, which are not laws that sacrifice who we are and what we do as a diverse, broadly accessible university. He also suggested a specific suggestion to establish a supporting bedrock principles task force of administrators, faculty, and representatives of staff and students, like the budget task force. He suggested such a task force specifically develop policies and protocols of support for those impacted by the federal government's actions. Reporter Purana Sanapranavar covers higher education for the Arizona Daily Star. And now, just past 20 minutes past the hour, we're going to turn to national and world news. Washington, states sue over HHS cuts. The suit. Administration can't eliminate funding approved by Congress. Rebecca Moon and Amanda Seitz of the Associated Press. Attorneys generals in 19 states and Washington, D.C. challenged cuts to the U.S. Health and Human Services Agency on Monday, saying the Trump administration's massive restructuring destroyed the life-saving programs and left states to pick up the bill for mounting health crises. The lawsuit was filed in federal court in Rhode Island, New York Attorney General Letitia James said. The attorneys general from Arizona, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Maine, Michigan, Maryland, Minnesota, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia signed into the complaint. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. restructured the agency in March, eliminating more than 10,000 employees and collapsing 28 agencies under the sprawling HHS umbrella into 15, the attorneys general said. President Donald Trump's administration already let go an additional 10,000 employees, according to the lawsuit, and combined the cuts stripped away 25% of the HHS workforce. In its first 3 months, Secretary Kennedy and his administration deprived HHS of the resources necessary to do its job, the attorney generals wrote. Kennedy says he wants to streamline the nation's public health agencies and reduce redundancies across them. HHS is one of the government's costliest federal agencies, with an annual budget of about $1.57 trillion that is mostly spent on health care coverage for millions of people enrolled in Medicare and Medicaid. AG Letitia James, who leads the lawsuit, called the restructuring a sweeping and unlawful assault that would endanger lives. This is not government reform. This is not efficiency, James said during a news conference on Monday. The cuts resulted in laboratories having limited testing for some infectious diseases, the federal government not tracking cancer risks among U.S. firefighters, early childhood learning programs left unsure of future funds, and programs aimed at monitoring cancer and maternal health closing, the attorney general said.
Cuts at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also hampered states' ability to respond to one of the largest measles outbreaks in recent years, the lawsuit says. This chaos and abandonment of the Kong department's core functions was not an unintended side effect, but rather the intended result, they said. They want a judge to vacate the directive because they say the administration can't unilaterally eliminate programs and funding created by Congress. Army pauses helicopter flights near D.C. airport. Officials confirmed two close calls last week at Reagan National Airport, Associated Press, Washington. The Army paused helicopter flights near a Washington airport after two commercial planes had to abort landings last week because of an Army Black Hawk helicopter that was flying to the Pentagon. The commander of the 12th Aviation Battalion directed the unit to pause helicopter flight operations around Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport following Thursday's close calls, two Army officials confirmed to the Associated Press on Monday. One official said the flights were paused since Friday. The pause comes after 67 people died in January when a passenger jet collided in midair with a Black Hawk helicopter at Reagan Airport. The official spoke on the condition of anonymity. The unit continues to fly in the greater Washington, D.C. region. The unit began a return to flight within the past week, with plans to gradually increase the number of flights over the next 4 weeks, according to an Army document viewed by the AP. Thursday's close call involved a Delta Airlines Airbus A319 and a Republic Airways Embraer E-170, according to the National Transportation Safety Board. And in the News Digest, Federal Reserve likely to maintain key rate. Washington. The Federal Reserve will likely keep its short-term interest rate unchanged on Wednesday, despite weeks of harsh criticism and demands from the President Donald Trump that the Fed reduce borrowing costs. After causing a sharp drop in financial markets 2 weeks ago by saying he could fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell, Trump subsequently backed off and said he has no intention of doing so. Still, he and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent say the Fed should cut rates. They argue that inflation has steadily cooled and high borrowing costs are no longer needed. Inflation did drop in March. And through the first 3 months of the year, it was at 3.6%, well above the Fed's 2% target. Hegseth directs military to cut four-star generals. Washington. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth directed the active-duty military to shed 20% of its four-star general officers Monday, as the Trump administration keeps pushing the services to streamline their top leadership positions. Hegseth also said, told the National Guard to shed 20% of its top positions. In a memo dated Monday, Hegseth said the cuts will remove redundant force structure to optimize and streamline leadership. On top of the cuts to the top-tier four-star generals, Hegseth also directed the military to shed 10% of its general and flag officers across the force, which can include any one-star or above equivalent Navy rank. Briefly, endangered species. Three Democratic U.S. Senators, Adam Schiff, Sheldon Whitehouse, and Cory Booker, sent a letter to the Trump administration asking for an explanation of how it analyzed a proposal to eliminate habitat protections for endangered and threatened species, whether industry had a hand in drafting it. Federal workers. Everett Kelly, the president of American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest union for federal workers, said Monday the organization's staff downsizing will devastate the services it provides members and threatens the group's survival. Labor strike. About 3,000 members of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers went on strike early Monday as jet engine maker Pratt & Whitney, and in Connecticut, as negotiations over wages, retirement benefits, and job security broke down. Their contract expired late Sunday. OpenAI. After months spent pursuing a plan to convert itself for a nonprofit to a for-profit business, OpenAI reversed course and said Monday its nonprofit will continue to control the company that makes ChatGPT and other artificial intelligence products. Middle East. Israel's military target Houthi rebels in Yemen's Red City of Hodeidah with a punishing round of airstrikes a day after the Iranian-backed rebels launched a missile strike that hit Israel's main airport. The rebels' media office said that at least six strikes hit the Hodeidah port Monday afternoon. Berkshire Hathaway. Billionaire Warren Buffett will remain chairman of the board at Berkshire Hathaway when Vice Chairman Greg Abel takes over from Buffett as CEO at the start of 2026. The board of directors voted Sunday to keep the legendary 94-year-old investor as head of the board. And this these briefs were brought to you by the Associated Press. Administration sued for blocking wind energy. States challenge order signed on Trump's first day back in office. Associated Press. A coalition of states' attorney general filed a lawsuit Monday against President Donald Trump's attempt to stop the development of wind energy. Attorneys general from 17 states and Washington, D.C., challenged an executive order Trump signed on the first day of office, pausing approvals, permits, and loans for all wind energy projects, both onshore and offshore. Trump doesn't have the authority to unilaterally shut down the permitting process, they say, and he jeopardized development of a power source critical to the state's economic vitality, energy mix, public health, and climate goals. They asked a federal judge to declare the order unlawful and stop federal agencies from implementing it. Trump vowed during the campaign to end offshore wind industry if he returned to office to the White House. His order said there were alleged legal deficiency underlying the federal government's leasing and permitting of wind projects, and it directed the Interior Secretary to review wind leasing and permitting practices for federal waters and lands. And now moving to Tucson and regional news. AZ lawmakers, hospitals required to check immigration status. This is from Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services, Phoenix. State lawmakers voted Monday to require hospitals to inquire whether patients are here illegally, despite concerns it would deter some people from seeking medical care. The bill's sponsor said she doesn't care about such concerns. They should stay in their own country if they want to have care, Flagstaff Republican Senator Wendy Rogers said during a committee hearing on her legislation. The proposal now goes to Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs after Monday's 32-25 vote by the House. Strictly speaking, the proposal does not link health care with legal status. Instead, it would require any hospital that accepts Medicaid payments to ask patients whether they are citizens here, are here lawfully or not lawfully present. The form would tell would-be patients that their answers won't affect their ability to get care and that the responses will not be reported to immigration authorities. Rogers said it's simply designed to create a report for the governor and legislatures of the cost of the care provided. This, generally speaking, isn't for care paid for by ACCESS, the state's Medicaid program. Those not here legally are not entitled to coverage except in narrow circumstances such as emergency situations. Instead, it would track uncompensated care provided by hospitals. But Senator Catherine Miranda said she was not reassured that this is simply a data-gathering operation. How can we be assured that this information won't be used for nefarious reasons? Asked the Levine Democrat. Rogers took offense to the question. The word nefarious is being applied to the consequences instead of the initial act of illegality, she said. I would say that's a specious premise. Rogers said her measure is modeled after a similar law Florida enacted in 2023. Phoenix Democratic Representative Sarah Liguori said that law, whatever its intent, seemed to be having an impact, with some residents lacking legal status moving out. But the flip side, she said, is that the state altered its child labor laws, which she said was done to make up for the number of people who disappeared from the state workforce. Closer to home, the vote comes on the heels of an undocumented Mexican man who is living in Tucson for nearly 15 years being detained by immigration officers last week while visiting Carondelet St. Joseph Hospital, where he had gone with a cousin who is requesting emergency care. In that case, an attorney for the man said his companion was questioned before being discharged about whether he had a Social Security number or a legal status. The lawyer said that led to the family to suspect someone at the hospital had contacted Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Carondelet could not be reached for a comment. During the debate in the House, Prescott Republican Representative Selena Bliss, a supporter of Rogers' measure, insisted that there would be no change in medical treatment. Bliss, who is a nurse, said that those who provide direct care healthcare don't know about and don't even ask questions unrelated to the medical issue. She said all the patients get care, regardless of the information they provide to intake clerks, such as their insurance or lack thereof. We don't have to worry about violating our oath because we are separated and protected from registration information, Bliss said. She said, though, that her experience convinces her that there's a need for information that the Senate Bill 1268 would provide. Bliss told colleagues that there were incidents where more than a decade ago in her community, far from the border, women in labor crossed into the United States to have their babies. We weren't capturing that data, but there should be some accounting, she said. Opponents, however, said it's clear that there would be fallout simply in requiring the question to be asked. Unfortunately, using bills like this that you're trying to sell as something that's not going to have any impact is absolutely outrageous, said Tucson Democratic Senator Alma Hernandez. We have people who are scared to go seek medical care. Nor is she convinced that the legislation leaves medical providers out of the loop. If someone is seeking medical care, it's not your job as a medical professional to say, "Show me your papers, and then I will treat you," Hernandez said. And I'm disappointed that, once again, we're putting the communities that are already struggling and already facing so many uncertainties in a situation where they have to decide, do I want to go seek the medical care that I should be receiving, or should I stay home and die? Because if I do, I will be deported. Representative Nick Cupper, a surprised Republican, said the plain language of the bill should reassure people that a visit to the hospital won't result in deportation. Responding to the question that would apparently be optional, the bill spells out the data can't be reported to immigration officials, he said. But Representative Mariana Sandoval said she's not buying that. History shows that such assurances could easily be undermined, said the Goodyear Democrat. She said that people don't need to look hard or far for an example. She pointed the decision last month by the IRS, whose records are normally confidential, to share tax information about some immigrants without legal status. Representative Nancy Gutierrez said this hurts families, including those with members who are here legally. I teach in a school that has many kids with mixed family status, the Tucson Democrat said. If they told me in the days of a prior bill, a lot like this one, their families would not go to the doctor and they had family members who would get sicker and not get treated because they were afraid they would get deported. Representative Lorena Austin said lawmakers need to understand the impact of their decision. Call me crazy, said the Mesa Democrat, but I believe health care is a human right. Marilyn Rodriguez, testifying on behalf of Planned Parenthood advocates, told lawmakers that the issue could go beyond the health of a person affected. As COVID-19 and the current flu epidemic make clear, your health and safety impacts my health and safety, she said. If someone has COVID, I want them to go to the hospital. Rogers, however, told colleagues, this is simply about gathering data. The fallout from that is irrelevant, she said. It's not my job to determine whether someone is dissuaded from care, especially if someone is not a citizen, Rogers said. She turned aside a question about how she feels about people possibly not getting care because of her legislation. This is not germane to that topic, Rogers said. And we're approaching 20 minutes before the hour. Homeschooling parents fight proposed voucher limits. This is from Madeline Parrish of the Arizona Republic. The Arizona Department of Education asked to postpone a vote on its proposed changes to the state's Empowerment Scholarship Account Program, which have drawn intense opposition from a number of homeschooling parents who say the changes would restrict their freedom to educate their children the way they see fit. The State Board of Education was set to vote on the changes during its April 28th meeting, but removed the item from the agenda at the Department of Education's request. Several legislators wanted to discuss the issue with the department, and we needed more time to facilitate that, Arizona Department of Education spokesman Doug Nick said. Department officials were to meet with House Majority Leader Michael Carbone, a Republican of Buckeye, who asked to discuss the general concerns raised by some parents, according to Nick. The department will also hold a public hearing on the handbook changes. Superintendent of Public Instruction Tom Horn, who runs the Department of Education, said at the April 28th meeting that these meetings will also involve negotiations over the details of the handbook. He suggested individuals hold their comments because the negotiations that may occur between legislators and myself may satisfy some complaints about the handbook. The ESA handbook outlines rules for the tens of thousands of families participating in the state school voucher program. The updated handbook now is set to go before the board for a vote in June. The Arizona Department of Education's proposed changes to the ESA handbook have faced fierce opposition since they first went to the State Board of Education in March. The changes, which would appear in the 2025 to 2026 handbook, if approved, included an expanded list of prohibited purchases, spending caps on certain expenses, and requirements that supplemental materials be tied to curriculum, an issue currently being litigated in Maricopa County Superior Court. At the March and April meetings, many homeschooling parents opposed the handbook's proposed spending caps. Those include caps of $500 per student for home economics, appliances, and accessories, $4,000 per student every 3 years for instruments, $2,500 per student every 3 years for physical education equipment, $3,000 per student for smart boards, $1,500 per student for, every 3 years for tools for vocational education, and $2,000 per student every 2 years for personal computers and laptops, parenthetically, all of which are provided through the public schools as well. Many parents also said the spending caps are already being imposed. In a statement, Horn said the department has insisted from day one of my administration that every ESA payment be for a valid educational purpose based on the market. We received some complaints that the department was not transparent about that, so we proposed to have this practice added to the parent handbook. Magic Perry Aldana, a homeschooled student in the ESA program, told board members on April 28th that she loves baking, but most of her tools probably won't last much longer, and $500 wouldn't be enough to replace something important. Parents weighed in as well. Megan Haraldson says limits would restrict her ability to purchase instruments for her 15-year-old autistic child. Michelle Van Gerp criticized the home economics cap, saying her son or her child has been working on a costume making character fabrication curriculum for her portfolio, and that $500 would not even purchase the base materials she needs for the project. Crystal Smith said she worried about spending caps would lead to a rabbit hole of regulations. The public has had enough of the overreach, Bianca Martinez said. Dozens more critical comments were submitted virtually by ESA parents. Some said the limits on vocational tools are not realistic, especially for high school students hoping to pursue multiple vocational paths. Some comments came from parents whose laptop purchases had been denied. One individual attached a message from the Department of Education said it had made an administrative decision to only reimburse up to $2,000 for the MacBook Air that the parents had purchased for more than $2,840. Another individual attached a message sent to the department attempting to appeal a rejected order, saying the $3,600 MacBook Pro was requested to last a child not only through high school, but also college and medical school. Another parent said her son needed a $5,000 Apple computer for the film production certificate he was working on, and the $2,000 cap would have made this purchase impossible. Many parents balked at the Department of Education statement that students with disabilities would be exempt from the spending caps, with notes from specialists saying that these notes would be difficult, if not impossible, to obtain. Specialists cannot or will not write letters for non-therapeutic items, no matter how educational, wrote Kristen Huff in an email to the board. Our speech therapist and occupational therapist both have a scope of practice which is that is managed by their licensor. They could not possibly face scrutiny for going outside the scope of practice to write these letters. Kelly Kenny told the board that it already takes weeks or months to get some specialists or to find a therapist accepting new patients. The proposed 2025-26 handbook also received criticism for being too lenient from the Arizona Education Association, a union representing educators across the state. Marisol Garcia, the organization's president, in particular criticized the Arizona Department of Education's practice of approving purchases of $2,000 or less and auditing them later, which began in response to a backlog of reimbursement requests. Save Our Schools Arizona, a public education advocacy group that organized against the expansions of the voucher program, expressed oppositions to the 2025-26 handbook as well. We acknowledge that the ADE has made a modicum of effort in this new version of the ESA parent handbook, set to common sense limits on some major purchases, and we strongly support the need for robust limits, plus increased transparency for public taxpayer dollars, said Save Our Schools co-directors Beth Lewis and Sharon Kirsch in a letter to the board. Overall, however, the handbook continues to fail to address the need for financial accountability within the ESA voucher program, they wrote. Amid the fight over ESA restrictions, Senator Jake Hoffman, a Queen Creek Republican and the leader of the Arizona Freedom Caucus, announced that a candidate will soon launch a campaign to challenge Horn in the 2026 Republican primary for a school superintendent. In early April, Hoffman called Horn the greatest single threat to school choice and the state's education voucher program. Horn, in response, said he was the main advocate for the ESA program. Hoffman thinks I have no right to restrict what parents get from ESA, Horn said. His position makes absolutely no sense, Horn said. I have a duty to taxpayers to be prudent with their funds, and I have to make sure that everything is a reasonable educational expense and the price is reasonable according to market prices. On April 28th, Hoffman said in a post on X that a candidate would launch a campaign against Horn in 2 to 3 weeks. The candidate, Hoffman said, would never run for this position, has never run for this position, and will protect educational freedom for all AZ kids. Horn's belligerent attempts to undermine educational freedom and his refusal to listen to parents will be his downfall, Hoffman wrote. And now turning to the lifestyle section, hints from Heloise. Write legibly when signing a guest book. Dear Eloise, following the death of my husband, our family was writing out thank you notes and ran into some issues of not being able to read the names that were signed on the cards or in the guest register. We also had problems not having the sympathizers' addresses and not being able to cash checks. Here are some suggestions we came up with for your readers when they sign guest books and give cards with memorial donations. please print your name and address in the guest book. When you drop a card in the box or send it in the mail, put one of your return address labels on the blank or left inside part of the card, along with a note of what your memorial contribution was and the group it should be donated to. If you write a check, please make it out to the family of, and then the name of the deceased. It is not always easy for the deceased's immediate family to cash a check if it's written out to another family member. These suggestions could also be used for birthdays, weddings, and anniversaries. Thank you. This is from Recent Widow versus via email. Postcard well wishes. Dear Eloise, I read your column in the weekend edition of the Telegraph in Alton, Illinois. My hint is an addition to the letter about sending postcards. For our daughter's high school graduation, we had a table with different types of postcards on it. We asked each guest to write her a postcard addressed and address the postcards later when we knew her college dorm assignment. We just drop some in the mail each week, all year long. For her freshman year, she's gotten mail and well wishes from friends and family back home. Thank you. This is from Joanie Daugherty via email. Emergency preparedness. Dear Eloise, when the lights go out, for whatever reason, people search for candles and matches. I have streamlined this process in my house by putting a tea light and a small box of matches into short, squat, cleaned-out jam jars. This way, everything is in one container, and the jars provide draft protection so the flame doesn't blow out. Also, wax can't drip on anything since the tea light is inside the jar. I have given these to friends and used my label machine to put "Be Prepared" on the jar. This is from L. Russell in Spokane, Washington. Vehicle registration. Dear Eloise, I read with interest the letter from A.H. in Kansas and wanted to offer some thoughts. Having lived in California and Colorado, there are high rates of car theft. Consequently, we have always thought that keeping automobile registration in your glove compartment or anywhere in the car is a bad idea. If the car is stolen, the thieves now know where you live and know that you are not home, as they just stole your car. Perhaps a better idea might be folding your registration card with your driver's license and keeping it in your wallet. Just thoughts on how to stay safe. Thanks for your consideration. This is from S. Paget via email. And you can send a money-saving or time-saving hint to Heloise at Heloise with an H, HELOISE.com. And Royal Stars from Georgia Nichols. Happy birthday for Tuesday, May 6th, 2025. You're attuned to others, empathetic with those who are less fortunate. You are supportive, strong-minded, and ready to share your ideas. This year is slower paced. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. You might make a powerful connection with someone today. In fact, you might feel this relationship was written in the stars. Tonight, wardrobe shopping. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. This is a positive day for you because the moon is dancing beautifully with the sun in your sign. Tonight, seek relationships. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Family discussions will go well today, especially interactions from a female relative. You will also feel close to a friend or in a member of a group. Tonight, romantic friendship. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Because of your communication skills are excellent today, it is a great day for those of you in sales, marketing, teaching, acting, or writing. Tonight, surprise flirtations. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. Financial matters and negotiations will go well today because the gods are with you. Meanwhile, you might develop a crush on someone who is different. Tonight, travel plans. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Lucky you. This is a strong day for you. The moon is in your sign, dancing beautifully with the sun. I think we heard that. It It's a great day to make travel plans or explore legal and medical issues. Tonight, you might receive a gift. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. You're happy to play things low-key today and work alone or behind the scenes. Meanwhile, relations are important to you today. Tonight, warm relationships. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21st. This is a great day to schmooze with friends because people are warm, friendly, and helpful. Tonight, work-related romance? Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. You're high viz today, which means people notice you more than usual. In fact, some people will know personal details about your private life. Tonight, socialize! Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. This is a great day for your sign. Enjoy schmoozing with others, plus socializing with friends and romantic partners. Tonight, cocoon. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. Today, you might feel a special connection with a sibling, relative, neighbor, or a daily contact. This connection is important to you. Tonight, people are helpful. Pisces, February 19th through March 20th. Be prepared to go more than halfway when dealing with others today. Nevertheless, conversations will be warm and mutually supportive. Tonight, retail therapy? And this is from King Features Features Syndicate. In sports, high school student athlete of the week, Empire looks to defend its crown. Ravens eye repeat title with ace Freidinger in the circle. This is from Elvia Verdugo, Arizona Daily Star. During the final at bat of last season's AIA State Softball Championship, Empire High School student and pitcher Kendall Freidinger threw two rise balls inside. The batter swung at both, putting two strikes on the board. When Empire was still ahead, the Valley Christian Trojans were attempting to make a comeback in the last inning by bringing in four runs, making the score 10-6. The pressure was on for Freidinger as her catcher called for her to throw another rise ball. Hopefully, this one is as good as the last one, she remembers thinking. It was. I threw the last pitch, and then me and my catcher, Abby Zitve, ran towards each other, and then it just turned into this giant group hug out in the field, she said, adding, the game was over, I was happy, and then I was sad, because it was like every single emotion hit me at the same time. It was crazy. I was crying. I was laughing. It was a lot. If Empire and Tankaverde beat their opponents in the quarterfinals on Wednesday, the two teams will face each other once again in the semifinals on Friday, May 9th. The possible matchup isn't as daunting as it sounds for Freidinger, who says her confidence as a pitcher has only grown over the last few years. But Freidinger isn't only getting wins in the field, she's getting them in the classroom too. She's part of the Vail Early College Program, where Vail students can earn college credits while still in high school. And she'll graduate from Empire with a 4.45 GPA. After graduation, Freidinger is headed to Weber State University on an athletic scholarship to study health administration with a minor in psychological studies. And this has been the Arizona Daily Star for May the 6th, 2025, brought to you through Sun Sounds of Arizona and read by David Grant. Have a great week.